I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The great American writer Mark Twain wrote in his notebook over 100 years ago that truth is mighty and will prevail. He went on to say that there's nothing the matter with this, except it ain't so. Well, there's more than a ring of truth to that for anyone who has stood at the edge of a mass grave and thought, this could, this should never happen again. This hour we'll meet Charlie Johnson. He's a cynical and aging foreign correspondent who, after over 30 years in the business, has seen far too much death. A reporter who finally sets out to right a wrong, to avenge or to understand one death. Now, the complex meaning of death is at the heart of Ignatieff's new novel, Charlie Johnson in the Flames. It's also the line that runs somewhere uninterrupted between Michael Ignatieff's fiction and his work as a human rights scholar. It's a question for all of us. Is it easier to explore issues of death in fiction rather than in newspapers and human rights reports? And in our culture, where we seem to place so much value on human life, does it mean that we're better or worse at coping with or understanding death? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is with me in the studio. His new book is called Charlie Johnson in the Flames. Good of you to come in again, Michael.
Nice to have me on, Dick.
The character Charlie Johnson here is someone who I guess in his various parts you've met in your own time, traveling in war zones, particularly in Bosnia or in Kosovo, where this one is set.
Definitely not me, yes. He's the guy in the bar who has just got the story you wanted to get, and he kind of pisses you off that he's got it and you haven't. Takes chances, smart, alert, seemingly untouched by what happens. You know, I've done some war reporting. I want to give everybody a government health warning that when the shooting starts, I put my Land Rover in reverse. You know, I'm not a danger seeker, but Charlie is definitely a danger seeker. And in some sense, he's slightly a dangerous guy. I mean, he gets the story, but oh boy, he can cause chaos all around him. He's that kind of character, i.e. not me.
But when we meet him at the beginning of the novel, he's starting to, I don't know if lose his appetite for that kind of work is a proper way of putting it, but there's a kind of, oh, here we go again, like one war zone's the same as the last war zone and one death is the same as the one he put in his last story.
Yeah, exactly. I think from frame one of this book, he's beginning to crack. Someone comes to him with a story. It's a good story, but it involves some risk, and he's suddenly at an age where he thinks, are these risks worth taking anymore? His whole lust for the chase is beginning to break down a bit.
Do you suppose that's because he has filed too many of these stories and seen no effect from that? I mean, certainly it's one of the things that inspires a reporter, whether or not you're covering City Hall or covering a war zone. You like to think that what you're doing is paid attention to somewhere. I don't know whether or not that's part of Charlie's losing his own spirit.
Yeah, I think he's aware suddenly that the chase that means that the story is the thing, the only thing. He suddenly, because he's in his 50s, or we don't know how old he is, but he's having a senior moment. That is, he's seeing that the game may not be worth the candle suddenly. He's going to do it one more time, but he's not sure. There's some cracking of his inner resolve, I think, from the beginning, some kind of, why are we doing this? And it turns out to be, the story turns out to be a catastrophe. I mean, it just, everything begins to go wrong very quickly.
I'm going to get you to read a passage from the book in a minute here, and that is when Charlie encounters this woman who is in flames. But maybe you can set that up for us. How is it that he gets into this ditch? How does he see this woman coming across the field or the yard towards him?
I should say that some of this is based on reporting experience I had in Kosovo in 98-99. He gets a tip that the rebels, I guess the Kosovo Liberation Army, you know, and although I don't, it's not very, it's, this is not a Kosovo novel, but it's kind of in that zone. He gets a tip that they are operating a base just inside the border. And if he can get down there and do a story, he can prove that the other side, in this case the Serbs, don't have control. So their claims that they control the whole area are not true. That's what the stake is here, but it's not a big stake. I mean, who really cares in the end, you know? And Charlie can sort of see that. So he goes down in the valley in the dark, extremely dangerous because he'll be shot on sight. And he is led by a guy who turns out to be unreliable. Big theme in journalism. You bet your store on a fixer to get you to a story, and the fixer screws up, or the fixer doesn't have it, or the fixer doesn't do it right. This fixer doesn't have it. Gets them in the wrong place. They have to take refuge in a house. Above them in the house is a father and daughter. When they break from cover, the journalists, Charlie and his team, break from cover out of the house. They give the location away. This woman then, the Serbs come and attack the house. She is then set on fire. That's the thing he sees. Charlie, from the safety of the woods, sees a woman set on fire. This is the thing suddenly that he just thinks, this is too much. And this is where the first episode...
description of that comes from. Yeah.
She had run from the house towards the woods where Charlie, Jacek, and Benny were hiding, running with her arms outstretched, with a fire on her back flaring like a cloak, hair on fire, back on fire, dress on fire, flames clinging to her while she ran. Charlie jumped into the road to stop her because he knew with lunatic clarity that running was a mistake. Running fans the flames. You never run when you're on fire. Every book tells you that. You flatten out, roll in the dust. So he stepped into her path to stop her, and she ran right into him, so that they rolled together on the red dirt of the road until they were one crumpled roll of melted flesh, Charlie beating on her back with his hands to douse the flames, as if he, Charlie Johnson, had been chosen by her embrace and anointed her, and anointed like her, with the flames. He knew he was crying out, and when he next opened his eyes, she was lying on top of him, stinking of gasoline and burned skin. She was shaking, and he was too, and they kept still, knowing that the squad might still be at the end of the road. He thought that if they did not move, someone might take them for dead. He was aware enough to feel that their bodies were transmitting identical intimations of fear. He could hear the flames from the burning roofs and shouts and the pop-pop of small arms. They were so tightly entwined that he could not see her face, but he could hear her moaning next to his ear.
It's Michael Ignatieff reading from his new book, Charlie Johnson in the Flames. And in this... this part of the book struck me because, and you've been working as a journalist in war zones, you've probably logged more time as a human rights scholar in similar places. I don't know, you can correct me, but in both instances, you're somewhat obliged to insinuate yourself into one side of the conflict or another. You're going to ask for a favor from someone at some point, like Charlie took a favor from these people who sheltered him, mm-hmm. and then go away without ever really knowing what the consequences of that are.
Yeah, exactly. I think that every reporter who gets shot at has to put other people in jeopardy. That's what it comes down to. Your translator, your fixer. Someone, in Charlie's case, you take shelter with a completely anonymous woman, and she gets killed as a result. It's not just that this is an atrocity. It's an atrocity where Charlie feels, and it begins to work through him, that it's his fault. He tries to save her. He tries to stop it, but he's burned by his own guilt at what happens. I don't want to overdo this. You know, reporting is a hard-boiled business. You know, you work with people. They take chances with you. But there are occasional moments when you see things where you think, I have put people in more jeopardy than is right. You know, I've really put them in the flames, and I shouldn't be doing this. And I think every reporter has moments when they feel real trouble over that. And the book is kind of about that.
I mean, in some cases, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know if you stopped and asked directions from somebody if you don't get them in trouble for talking with the Westerners in that car. But in your case, working in Bosnia, in Kosovo, was this something that, I mean, did part of the idea for this come from what have I just done? Like, was being in that village, are there consequences for the people who I've left behind by being there?
I remember one incident. Again, I want to stress, you know, this is, you know, I've not very often been in harm and harm's way, and I'm one of life's cowards. But there was one occasion in Croatia, actually, in 92, when I, in a light-minded moment, invited a Canadian of Croatian origin to serve as my translator when we went through Serb zones. And we were stopped by a Serb paramilitary patrol who were all livid drunk. I mean, glassy-eyed drunk. We went into a police station. They messed with this guy for about 5 hours, you know, because his mother's name was, somehow they pried out of him that he was a Croat. And I began to think, as I watched them really work this guy over, not physical abuse, but just a torrent of verbal abuse that was just slowly cracking him apart, that I got this poor 22-year-old kid who happened to speak the language into big trouble, more trouble than he deserved. Or, you know, and I felt a kind of responsibility for what happened. Now, fortunately, we got out, but that grilling, that shaking of this guy's inner moral confidence really affected me. And there's a scene in the book which kind of replays some of that. You know, it just, you feel bad that you put someone in. And it's one thing to put yourself in these situations. You know, it's a free choice. And if you make a mistake, you make a mistake. But you don't kind of want to put other people in there as well with you, especially when they begin to crack.
Is writing about that in fiction easier than finding a place to put it somewhere in a human rights report or in a story about what's going on? I mean, I'm suspecting that's the case, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, that's right, Dick. I mean, I do fiction. I mean, nobody in their right mind should do fiction. It's the most difficult thing of all. I mean, it's just the hardest, and I'm not saying I'm great at it, but I know what the impulse behind it is, which is that there's a whole lot of stuff I can't talk about in nonfiction. I can't talk about these very intimate personal issues of moral responsibility, these issues of guilt, these issues of regret about things that happen on the road. And this was a book in which I could put some of that much more personal stuff down. You really can't. I mean, you're doing human rights reporting or human rights thinking. It's not about you, and it shouldn't be about you. But this is much more a book about the dilemmas of solidarity, the dilemmas of taking one person's fate really seriously. This woman dies. Charlie feels responsibility. What is it to take responsibility for someone else's fate? This is, you know, in human rights reporting, we're always talking about solidarity with victims. This is just one attempt to look at what it really, really means. If you were going to go down all the way with this issue of solidarity, keeping faith with someone's, you know, misfortune, what would it entail? It turns out to entail your destruction, right? So I wanted to go there into areas that, you know, the human rights side of my life, the nonfiction side of my life just doesn't go to at all.
Connection listeners, we want to bring you into this conversation as readers and as listeners, and also to join the conversation about whether or not fiction allows us ways of considering issues that aren't really that available to us in nonfiction or in the more cold and clinical reporting of what goes on in the nastier parts of the world. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Michael Ignatieff. We're talking about his new book. It's called Charlie Johnson in the Flames. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Ignatieff is with me. We're talking about his new book. It's a novel. It's called Charlie Johnson in the Flames. Charlie Johnson, this aging reporter who decides that he's going to try and correct one wrong, right one wrong. Charlie goes a little bit off the reservation in his attempt to do this. Michael, I don't know, is he looking for a happy ending? Does he figure that he can fix something here?
I think Charlie is very confused. One of the characters says, after he comes back from this episode where the woman's been burned, "You're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder." And he says, "Don't give me that kind of guff. You know, that's not the problem. I'm fine." But he's obviously cracking up inside. He goes to Belgrade to find the guy who he saw light this woman up, and he doesn't know what he's looking for. He wants a moment of truth. He wants to confront the guy. He wants the guy to understand what it is, what you actually do when you set another human being on fire. He wants to, in a world where we're saturated with atrocity footage, you know, even those who commit the atrocities start to forget what it is they've actually done. He has some idea that if he could just make this guy feel what it's like to do that to a woman, kind of there'd be some closure. But anyway, it all goes kind of wrong, and I don't want to give the ending away, but, you know, it's a kind of, he has a revenge fantasy, he has a justice fantasy, he has a truth fantasy, and nothing happens the way he plans.
Why is it that the wise people in the story are the women?
Well, that's generally been my life experience, I have to say.
Etta, the office manager from Charlie's television outfit, comes to give him a hand. Magda is the woman who's the companion of his longtime camera operator. These two really provide the sort of insight here that it seems like the men can't quite get their hands on.
I know. I don't know why that is. I don't know why it's structured like that. That I don't want to make it a cliche in the sense, you know, women shouldn't be asked to bear the burden of all these expectations of wisdom, right? I mean, you know, but in this book, Etta sees Charlie much more clearly than Charlie sees himself. And I think that's certainly been, you know, often my understanding. I mean, Charlie is meant to be very unreliable. Charlie's meant to be somebody who has very imperfect grasp of what the hell he's doing, why he's doing what he's doing. And Etta sees it much more clearly. And at the end of the book, she seems to see something about him that he didn't see, which is that in some sense, Charlie is an innocent.
I was going to ask you what you say. Charlie is an innocent, like it is. I mean, it's more often an adjective than a noun, right?
Right. He's an innocent in the sense that, and it's something you see a lot out there, is that journalists are often people who have much more life experience than they know what to do with, and much more experience of the world than they've ever been able to digest or reflect upon. So it's just one story after another, and nothing ever gets in. Charlie's that, but he's also someone who I think is perpetually surprised in a kind of naive way about how awful the world is. He simply cannot get it into his head that we live in a world where one human being can set another human being on fire. And that, Etta thinks, is a kind of innocence that nobody should have. So it's about that kind of innocence. And I have it. You know, I think to myself, how could it be possible to live in a world where one human being sets another human? It happens every day. It happens in Boston. It happens in New York. And it happens far away. This is the world we live in, Etta seems to be telling him. And Charlie just can't understand that.
There's a passage right at the very end of the book when you kind of pull a curtain back on why it is Etta carries this stoic wisdom through the book. And I don't think I'm asking you to give away too much by getting you to read that to us. Can I ask you to do that? She's staying with the cameraman, Jacek and Magda at this point, right?
Yeah. Etta was leaving the next day. Going back to work, she said. Dinner was over, and they were all seated round the table in front of the fire, when she said finally, without any preliminary, that she thought Charlie had been an innocent. Magda asked her what she meant, and Etta paused and looked at her wine glass and pushed a strand of her blonde hair off her face and said that when she was 18 in her country, she had been raped. A family friend, she said, with no particular emphasis or irony, correcting herself, not a friend exactly, a member of the family, her mother's younger brother, Uncle Janosch, out of the blue, as they say in English. He still lived in the town where she grew up, and her parents never knew, and life went on as if nothing had happened. But that was why, she added, she left home, and why she had begun again. Magda reached out her hand, but Etta gently shook her head as if to say she wasn't looking for consolation. She looked at Magda calmly and said in that thoughtful and slightly accented voice, I do not want you to misunderstand. It was an experience that taught me that we live in a world where there are people who do this, Whether they understand what they do or not does not matter. Why they do it is not an interesting question. What matters is that they do it.
Michael Ignatieff, reading from Charlie Johnson in The Flames. And you know that quite often you're tripping along in a story that has a strong narrative, and you stumble sort of face first into a comment like that of it, as that passage had that effect on me. Why they do it is not an interesting question. And I don't want to belabor this, but it draws me to go back to your own experience in the real world, and ask if why they do it is no longer an interesting question. Why do we? I mean, then why do we pay so much attention to the fact that it's done? Right?
Yeah, you put your finger on an interesting issue, because I've spent my whole adult life as a thinking person trying to answer the question that Etta says is not an interesting question, namely, why do people commit atrocities? Why does ethnic cleansing occur? Why is it a rational political strategy? One of the things the book tries to say is that this atrocity, the lighting of this woman on fire, is actually a rational strategy of control. The French have this wonderful phrase, we do it pour encourager les autres. That is to say, we do it to intimidate, silence, and control other people. Atrocity is a rational strategy. There's an endless amount of things you can say about why people do it. But somehow, Etta is saying, look, at the end of the day, what matters is that they do it, and what matters is that they get stopped. She's making a plea against intellectualization on the one hand, and against innocence on the other. You know, oh, isn't it astonishing that man's humanity to man. She's saying, that's not interesting. Man is wolf to man. That's the deal, is she saying. And I think she's right about that. So then the issue is, what are you prepared to do to stop it? Charlie tries to stop it and pays the price. But he may have been innocent to be surprised, morally wounded by it. We live in a world where fellow human beings do this all the time, and that's the world we have to live in. That's the world we have to try to change. But understanding it, making it a big intellectual issue, may be a diversion.
So where do you come down? I mean, you're not going to finish this novel and say, oh, everything that I've been working on is a waste of time. I like the second part of what you said. What matters is that they do it. Yeah. Because whether it's, you know, exploring mass graves in Iraq, which is, I think, something that you'll be doing some traveling.
Indeed, in late March.
Yeah. In late March. And whether or not you carry with you a different set of criteria, the older you get, the more experienced you get, the more jaded you get, or the more innocent you are, I'm not sure. But these are the thoughts that certainly go through a foreign correspondent's mind. You know, what am I going to see? What am I going to do? How am I going to tell the story? And yours as well.
Yeah. I think it's important not to get jaded, not to get cynical. Etta's not saying, you know, it's not, you know, forget intellectual curiosity and moral commitment. She's just saying, understand the world you're in. Understand the real world you're in. Don't be surprised when the world is as rough as it is. Live in this world, not in some fantasy world of your dreams. That has political implications. I mean, I do think that, you know, the central political problem of our time is understanding we live in a wicked world. Evil is a very palpable reality in our world, and you can't wish it away or pretend it away or be surprised by it. It's happening all the time. And then the political question of life is how you stop it, how you keep it from surging through our family lives, how you keep it surging through our politics, this evil that is actually rational. It's not demonic. There are all kinds of very good reasons why people commit evil acts. We have to stop them. That's what she's saying.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to join us. Michael Ignatieff is my guest. We're talking about his new novel, Charlie Johnson in the Flames. Connection listeners will know Michael more for his work as a human rights scholar and author of other books like Virtual War, Kosovo and Beyond, Human Rights and Politics as Politics and Idolatry, Empire Light, his most recent. This is a novel and a different perspective on the world. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Philip, you're with us. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having this as a topic. I would compliment you on some of the free thinking that you're just the free flow of conversation that you're having, I guess, kind of with yourself and with us, the listeners. But I would also say that I think you're right that fiction is a very good place to explore death and then the immorality of war. There are some beautiful works by people like Ernest Hemingway that explored the atrocities of World War One. And there are also some works of film that talk about that. There was a good film called The Quiet American that was made recently. That was a very, I think, objective and realistic look at the politics of betrayal and the politics of war and nationalism.
Philip, can I interrupt you here? Because
sure.
I'm interested in your perspective. What is it that someone like Hemingway can do, using as few words as he does and as little description as he does, to kind of draw our attention that in a way that, you know, a newspaper story can't or doesn't?
He gets you past the jingoism and gets you past the dry facts and puts you exactly there in the ambulance or in the hospital recovering. There are some beautiful scenes where he's recovering in the hospital in Italy, and they call him Tenente, the Italian physician there. And he puts you in the reality of what really happens to people, what the consequences are of a mortal wound or of a crippling, and also the disillusionment of all the thousands of unnecessary deaths that it costs when we decide to solve our problems with violence. You get to see that. It's much more personal, and it's also the room to explore what you can't do in a report about how many people died in Iraq.
Don't go anywhere, you know, Philip. I want to hear from Michael for a minute here, though.
I think Philip's put it with exceptional beauty. I mean, the Hemingway example is one of the best examples that we have. It's one of the reasons he's an unforgettably great writer. I think the only thing I would add is that The thing that fiction has to do is break through abstraction. Any kind of nonfiction work that I, for example, do about atrocity or death or evil always has a certain abstract quality. The thing that fiction has to do is, as Philip is saying, it's got to put you in the hospital room. It's got to put you in the hospital bed. You've got to take off your own helmet and get inside the helmet of someone suffering, hurting, and dying. And great fiction has that capacity to break the gap between us and someone else. And I think that's what Philip sees about good fiction. I don't want to say I've got there or I'm doing it, but I know that's what I want to do. And I know that's why people care about fiction, because it breaks through the abstraction, the distance, the... And it's the abstraction distance that renders killing and evil acceptable. And you got to feel the reality of these things. And fiction is the best way to do that.
Yes. Did you read Michael Ayer's book called Dispatches, which is about the Vietnam War?
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Wonderful piece of work. And those, I would recommend it to people. And I must say that...
Dispatching is nonfiction, though, isn't it? If my recollection...
It's kind of a novelization. I think it's a collection of all his reports.
Yeah.
And he puts himself, he steps out of his journalistic skin, and he becomes emotionally, I mean, he lets the reader know what it feels like to him, which is kind of a fiction device, because he goes into his own emotions and the emotions of the people that he experiences the Vietnam War with, and the people that he loses, and what he loses of himself. I would also add that that to not give up hope, although it does look hopeless at times, because these examinations and these telling of the stories is a wearing away. It's kind of like rain on granite, maybe, to help change the world and to help make it less evil, I would guess.
Why is it, and I'm going to ask you both this question, Philip, you first, why is it that our own sense of what nonfiction ought to be doesn't make space for the types of feelings and emotions that you're describing? Because her kind of straddles that, as you're saying, Philip, but what Michael is saying is that there's too much, or I guess not enough, of that sense of horror in something that we say this has to be nonfiction. Philip, what about what do you think?
That's a hard question to answer. I think we put distance. We purposefully, just for our own mental health, put distance between ourselves and that which is too horrible to absorb, to digest. And I think that the that fiction is a way to explore. I mean, a lot of things happen, a lot of movements, a lot of ideas and ideology gets changed because of people who come to see what is true about the subject that they're looking at. I think fiction is a way to get to that, and it's something that you don't, you know, the normal person doesn't have someone shot in their front yard. You know, it's something that we don't experience firsthand, and nor do we seek to do it. But you must understand it, and I think that the lack of understanding or the lack of looking for truth is what disturbs me sometimes.
I think the other thing to add is that there's almost nothing that we spend more time trying to fictionalize than violent death. I mean, I watch a lot of TV, and we spend a lot of our imaginative life talking about killing and dying. Every TV show, I watch a lot of Law and Order. Every show, it begins with someone dying in the first 90 seconds of that show. Well, the thing that is a constant challenge is to avoid representations of killing and dying that take away its reality so that we start to have crazy fantasies about it. We don't understand what it is for a human being to suffer and die. And the great thing about fiction is that it's not just trying to tell us the truth, but it's fighting against false versions of killing and dying. Now, I'm not trashing Law and Order. Sometimes it does a pretty good job of, you know, but that there's a struggle going on here, and fiction is in the front line. That's why I love your reference to Hemingway, a struggle to make us see, to make us morally see what is entailed when a person gets shot and dies.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, and your opportunity to join my conversation this hour with Michael Ignatieff. We're talking about his new novel, Charlie Johnson in the Flames, which is a new and another way of looking at death and what that brings us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Michael Ignatieff. He is director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University, author of a whole pile of books. This hour, we're talking about his latest piece of fiction. It's called Charlie Johnson in the Flames. And I was going back through the book of Michael's called Scar Tissue, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and came across this passage, which I'll read. This is in a speech that his narrator is giving as the narrator's busy trying to come to terms with his father's death and his mother's dying. And he says, "The real problem, of course, is what we are to think of death. People like us who live by the values of self-mastery are not especially good at dying, at submitting to biological destiny. The modern problem is not death without religious consolation, without an afterlife. The problem is that death makes the modern secular religion of self-development and self-improvement appear senseless. We are addicted to a vision of life as narrative, which we compose as we go along. In fact, we didn't have anything to do with the beginning of the story. We are merely allowed to dabble with the middle, and the end is mostly not up to us at all, but to genetics, biological fate, and chance. Accepting death would mean giving up on the metaphor of life as narrative." Scar Tissue, if you haven't read it, incidentally, is something of a fascinating rumination on death. And Michael, I couldn't help but think about that and think about how in that story you take and you hold our face right up to a family member trying to come to terms with death within that's so, so close. And then thinking, huh, I wonder how Michael squares that with gazing over the edge of a pit in another country at a bunch of bodies that don't have names and faces, because it's death again.
Yeah, it's death again. That piece you quote is a good example of the kind of chat that we throw at death, you know, our frantic attempts to understand something that that can't be understood. I'm a bit surprised to hear that all quoted back and see the linkage between what Charlie Johnson's trying to think about, which is just what is the reality of one woman's death? What was it for her to suffer and die in this way? What must follow from that? What are our responsibilities as a result of that? And all this stuff from 10 years ago. I obviously have a one-track mind.
Or you just haven't got the answer to the question that no one else has found either. 1-800-423-8255 to Concord, Massachusetts now. And Mara's joining us. Mara, thanks for calling.
Hi, great show. Hi, Professor Ignatieff. It's Mara.
Hi. Oh, good morning.
Good morning to you. And Scar Tissue was indeed a great book. I wanted to push you in the other direction of the empathy question, which is how do you or how does your protagonist deal with the desire to do harm in return to seeing harm. When you stare into the abyss and you begin to feel the abyss in yourself and to want to respond aggressively, how do you wrestle with that violence inside of you?
Hmm. It's a very, very good and difficult question. And Charlie Johnson certainly has very murderous ideas about the guy who sets this woman on fire. He is very, very badly out of control when he goes to see the colonel who's responsible for this atrocity. He doesn't really, I think, have any idea how deep these murderous desires go. In some sense, the book is a kind of cautionary tale about confusing a desire for justice with a desire for revenge. Justice is an extremely violent emotion. Often a very hate-filled emotion. Justice purifies revenge. Justice allows us to say it's a noble aspiration. The book is partly saying that Charlie's desire for justice conceals beneath it a very, very murderous desire for revenge. So it's a kind of, in answer to your question, I guess I've only got a negative thing to say, Mara, which is, don't allow feelings of justice to beautify your lust for revenge. Don't get confused about what justice doesn't necessarily make these dark emotions more noble or more acceptable. Justice may only be a screen that conceals something much more murderous. And so it's an attempt to think about those issues.
Mara, back to you.
I think that's a very helpful answer. And one thing I'm responding to is that you talk about atrocities as a rational response. And I know that as a professor and as a journalist, you respond to these rational choices for atrocity with rational arguments for democratic theory. But are those a way of keeping your desire for committing
this is a personal question. I think Mara's looking for a personal answer here.
Well, Mara turns out to be a student of mine, a very good student. It's very nice to hear you in another mode. I think it's terribly important to understand the logic of atrocity. I think it's very important not to demonize anybody or any human being, even those who commit crimes and atrocities. Despite what Etta says, it is important to understand why people do it. But it's also important to hold a clear distinction in your mind between understanding and judgment. I hate the violence I see. I loathe the violence I see. I want it stopped. I want it punished. But I also want justice to be done in a way that's free of simple murderous desire to punish. I want us to get control of these emotions so we do the right thing. And the book is just throws you into the maelstrom of all these emotions. And I guess Etta is saying, sort yourself out. Understand what you're doing. Don't go off like an unguided missile here. This book is not an endorsement of Charlie's course, which is to seek revenge. It's an attempt to say all of these emotions that are coursing through Charlie need to be understood, need to be controlled. We need to master ourselves here, and we master ourselves very, very poorly.
But justice is revenge to a lot of people, who will put victims' rights ahead of, some sort of book value of justice or the death penalty as a, you know, the ultimate form of justice. Mm-hmm. That is justice as revenge or revenge as justice, isn't it? And that, and those, I'm not talking about Sharia law and you know, a sort of knee-jerk liberal response to ick, eye for an eye. Sure. I mean, it exists all around the world.
Sure, sure. Justice is revenge. And justice, to be justice at all, has to be powered by very passionate and powerful emotions. The people who lost loved ones in 9/11, the people who've lost loved ones in Iraq, mm-hmm. you know, long for justice because they want the world to make sense again. They want justice, the noble yearning that justice serves is the yearning to have a world that makes sense, that has an order, that's not just unremitting cruelty and violence. And when justice serves that yearning, it's a very powerful and wonderful thing. So it's all a matter of understanding the emotions that surge through our yearning for justice, some of our yearnings for justice, which is for order, to establish moral order in the world, makes sense to me. Some of the ones which are, let's exterminate this guy, are less noble and have to be controlled, and our entire legal system exists to control that. In other words, it's not that the desire for revenge is ignoble or wrong, but that it has to be controlled. And we have institutions called, you know, we have courts which put this stuff through an institutional filter to make sure that we don't just take people and treat them like garbage. We do justice properly in the service of a moral idea of reparation and purification of the world of evil. All that's fine, but we got to do it right. We can't just let emotions rip through here because the thing about emotions is that they're all self-justifying. In the grip of emotions, we feel pure and exalted and noble and all this stuff. And Charlie is saying, the book is saying, watch out for this stuff. It's, you know, there's nothing self-justifying about an emotion. Most emotion is actually wrong.
But isn't it also emotion, Michael, that makes Charlie an innocent, that makes Charlie want to try and fix something? Isn't it also emotion that you rely on when you feel revulsion at witnessing some kind of violence? I mean, you can't take that out of the equation at all, right? I mean, in the long run, what Charlie is doing, he does it very badly, but his sort of misguided notion that maybe he's going to fix something is supposed to be honorable, isn't it?
Yeah. No, of course. I mean, he goes after the colonel. He goes after the person responsible for this atrocity. He wants the colonel to go through some of the things that justice is about, which is acknowledging the truth of what you have done, which is that you have treated another human being like a piece of garbage. He wants that to happen. He also wants, at some level, to kill this guy, you know. Without these emotions, no good would ever be done in the world. I'm not, you know, it's obvious. No good would be done in the world unless we had strong feelings of revulsion against evil. The problem is that those emotions of revulsion need to be disciplined and ordered. That's why we have law. Law is essentially an institutional solution to the problem of managing the emotions around justice. You know? And so I'm a, you know, that gets me back to my day job, which is human rights. Human rights is all about not just serving the emotions that are aroused by injustice, but also serving the emotions that are desired to protect even perpetrators from our desire for justice, ensuring that perpetrators, the Milosevic's of this world, the Saddam Hussein's of this world, get a fair trial, get the justice that they deny to others. I mean, the biggest moral problem we've got in the world is doing justice towards those who show no justice to us. That's a huge problem for us. It happens in every court in the United States. It happens internationally. Mastering these emotions.
Are you saying that it's not enough, Michael, to look at Saddam Hussein or Slobodan Milosevic and say, I'm a better person, we are a better people for not, you know, sentencing that person to the same violence or injustice that marked their own life? You're saying that it's a little bit, it's more than that. It's not quite enough to just say, I'm a better person if I don't whack you on the head, right?
Yes, this is not an exercise for the display of our moral narcissism. You know, aren't we great that we haven't killed Saddam? Aren't we great that we haven't tortured him? No, I mean, the deal is we're committed to justice in the proper sense of the rule of law. That's what we've signed on to as members of a democracy. What I'm trying to say here is that, because I teach human rights is a moral discipline. It's an attempt to apply moral discipline to our longings for justice, our longings for freedom, our longings for fairness in the world. And the discipline that it requires when we're faced with a really evil perpetrator like Saddam is we just have to do it properly. We have to give this odious creep his day in court. We got to do it right. We got to present evidence. We got to convince, you know, people beyond a reasonable doubt. All this standard stuff is terribly important as a discipline against the emotions, the righteous emotions, the righteous fury that we feel has to be disciplined. That's what human rights is saying. That's what, you know, in a sense, I'm trying to explore in this book.
Because
Charlie's completely undisciplined. Charlie is just an unguided missile. He just wants to be an avenging angel. And I just think that's wrong.
So it's important that there be divisions between. This is a human rights report. This is a journalist story based on what he or she saw. And this is what fiction can do in, like, pushing somebody way further into a feeling of emotion or to an experience of what it's like to be there or to feel whatever was felt. What you're saying is keep the divisions because they keep us.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful human rights organization in this town called Physicians for Human Rights. They spend their lives looking into open graves with bodies. They spend their lives trying to figure out the forensic truth of the awful things that happen to people. Their reports, when they're done properly, and PHR does a wonderful job, are very dispassionate, very cold. A lot of my students think, why are they so cold and so dispassionate? Because they're doing their job, which is you've got to separate these emotions out. You've got to present forensic truth in all its naked, plain starkness. And that's the only way to do a professional job here. And it's the only way to master the emotions that serve justice. You know, a PHR report or a Human Rights Watch report that is suffused with righteous indignation is mostly a waste of time. Leave that to the editorialists. Leave that to the fiction writers. Leave that to, you know, everything is what it is and not another thing. And we've got to keep these divisions, as you say.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Michael Ignatieff, director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University. His new novel is Charlie Johnson in the Flames. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.